is no secret that I love coffee, but it may still not be that widely known that the secret to making the best coffee at home is starting with freshly roasted beans. So which coffee should you turn to when you want to be sure you're getting only the freshest coffee? Well, the answer is La La Land. La La Land starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly we lost, by the way.
Guys, I'm sorry. No, there's a mistake. Sparkplug, you make the freshest coffee. This is not a joke. This is not a joke, guys. Sparkplug makes the freshest coffee. Sparkplug.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. It's right there on the card. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. But best of all, Sparkplug delivers this delicious coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. They even offer autopilot, set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. I promise you will taste the difference. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So, plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
If that PricewaterhouseCoopers guy had been drinking coffee instead of tweeting, maybe this joke wouldn't exist in the first place.
But that moment kind of made the whole broadcast worthwhile.
We'll never forget it.
Nope.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hey there, hi there, motion picture holics, and thanks for downloading the Next 100 Project, the podcast that dips and dives into the realm of classic films. This one, I guess, is a modern classic. If you don't like spoilers, you're going to think poorly of us. My name is Ryan Ellis, and here's my co-host and wife, Bev Ellis.
That's me.
Okay, this week's coming attraction trivia for Moonlight, a movie that, yes, is not even a year old. Between last year's Best Picture Oscar rivals, you know which one of them is now, La La Land, which movie had the better ending, La La Land, with its fantasy of what might have been, or Moonlight's tender reconciliation scene?
So you're going to get a long answer. It's your fault for asking. An opinion question. This question was hard. They both have magnificent endings. In La La Land, the ending is the best part of the film, and it's so good that it kind of redeems some of the film's flaws. Also, that sequence could stand alone as a great piece of art, where the ending in Moonlight relies on the build of the entire film and gets us to a place where Chiron's vulnerability is pure catharsis. It relies on the success of the film as a whole and earns the hell out of that moment, which is the most moved I felt in a theater last year. So, La La Land dazzles me, and Moonlight moves me.
It's close, but I'd say La La Land.
I got away with not picking one.
They're two of the best endings in modern history, really, so it's funny that they were up for the Oscar.
It's incredible, yeah. It's so rewarding, both of these films. But Moonlight's ending is only good because the whole film gets you there.
Okay, the Next 100 Project's 66th film, Moonlight, was certainly not nominated for any AFI Top 100 lists. They've been done for years, and Moonlight is still so new. After turning up at a bunch of festivals in the fall last year, Moonlight was out there for everyone in November. Being a small-budget indie production, the approximately $30 million haul made it a pretty good hit. It actually pulled in $65 million worldwide. Well, Bev, people probably know about this movie, but maybe don't know what it's about, so give them a skinny.
Alex Hibbert, Ashton Sanders, and Trevante Rhodes play Chiron, a gay black kid being raised in the projects of Miami. We follow him through childhood, teenagehood, and young adulthood as he struggles to grow up and find his place in a world where he doesn't belong. With no help from his crack-addicted mother, played by Naomi Harris, but lots of help from a crack dealer, played by Mahershala Ali, who somewhat adopts the sensitive young man.
Or, in a nutshell, Brokeback in the Hood.
Oh, this movie reminded me of Brokeback so much. Also a little of Carol, mostly because the subject matter of a forbidden gay romance and also like a similarly cathartic ending.
And your favorite movie from a couple of years ago.
You know, I was thinking about this, about why I, in particular, love these movies. Carol and Brokeback and Moonlight are movies that move me so deeply. What is it that's so special about them? I think it's because the stakes are way higher in films about gay protagonists looking for love. Romeo and Juliet may have their families standing between them and their love affair, but there's always the looming assurance that if things don't work out for their love, well, I mean, maybe Romeo and Juliet's a bad example, but if they get forced to break up, and any couple like that where something stands between them, if it's too fraught for their love to survive, they will carry on and find love with someone more appropriate. But Chiron has to choose between love in the life of loneliness. He has to choose to accept love against all the very real forces that stand between him and Kevin, or it's a very bleak outlook for him. So I think that's why they move me so much. I'm so invested by the end.
Kevin's one of the few characters who's in all three sequences of this film, too. He's the young kid, he's a teenager, and he's the grown-up, just like Chiron is.
And like Chiron, Barry Jenkins, the director, cast three different actors to play the same role.
And apparently didn't let the Chirons interact with each other. And that's pretty incredible, considering their performances are all damn good, and they're similar enough. I think the middle kid maybe doesn't look and act enough like the other two versions, but then you can be different as you grow older. I'm sure I was different when I was 10, and then when I was 15, and then when I was 25. Well, whatever age is he supposed to be in all these sequences?
One of the themes that this film explores successfully, very successfully, is the idea that in many ways we are totally different people between childhood, teenagehood, adulthood. You know, when you look back at the way you behaved, the things you believed, the decisions that you made when you were 16 years old, doesn't it just feel like that was a totally different person?
Whole different lifetime. Especially when you're 43 years old. That's almost 30 years ago.
Right, yeah. You're very old, it's true.
I am.
We do change dramatically. In many ways, we stay the same. And in many ways, he does stay the same. But you can't ignore, as these significant moments in his life happen, he becomes a truly different person. Like, he travels a different path because he met Juan, or because him and Kevin had an altercation that sent him to prison.
Well, what's funny is that the last time we ever see Mahershala Ali's character, Juan, is the faggot conversation, which is a very important moment in the whole film. When he says, you're not a faggot. If you're gay, that's fine. That's one thing. It's okay to be that, but don't let somebody call you a faggot. And at the end of that conversation, the young Chiron is asking Juan if he deals drugs. And then the math is done quickly by the kid. He walks away saying, it's people like you that got my mother hooked. Now, she's her own person, she doesn't have to do drugs, but she makes that same point to Juan as well, and you know he does feel a little guilty about that. Maybe it's fitting rather than ironic that the adult Chiron becomes a drug dealer, and also has the same gold statue on his car. He's more street-tough looking than Juan is. I mean, the guy is huge and intimidating, has that weird grill in his teeth.
So did Juan. Juan has a grill on the bottom teeth.
Only the bottom, then?
Yeah, oh, and he's cut. He's massive.
Well, maybe because he plays them with such sensitivity. Not to say that Trevante Rhodes doesn't, but until Trevante Rhodes has his moments with Kevin where he's alone, he's a scary-looking dude. I think that guy could be a great actor, but he does certainly fit the bill of being a tough-looking drug dealer. Not that Mahershala Ali doesn't, but all the scenes that he has as Juan, he seems like this nice dude. It's such a strange way to portray a drug dealer who's this almost innocent.
He's not innocent. He knows he's not innocent. But he had to find a way to survive just like Chiron does. Mm-hmm. When he takes Chiron under his wing, it's an attempt to teach him how to survive, not how to be himself. These are all luxuries that we enjoy with our Canadian, white, middle-class upbringing. Being yourself is the goal. Happiness is the goal. To someone like Chiron, it's going to be hard as hell to just make it. And you see him struggling. You see his loneliness and his alienation, and he has no one, really. Like, he has his mother who's useless. He only has Juan to look up to, so...
And Teresa.
And Teresa, but when the time comes for him to create himself from scratch, when he moves to Atlanta, he does the only thing that he's ever really seen work, even though I presume it has something to do with the reason Juan died. He becomes Juan. He does everything Juan does, down to, like you said, the adornments in his car. He has the same crown. He wears the same grills. He dresses the same. I guess he never really saw how Juan acted with his employees.
Well, maybe we never saw that happen, but maybe he did.
Yeah, that's possible. But that's the version of manhood that he saw succeed in his world. So that's what he adopts. We say he doesn't think he has any options, but truly, does he have options?
Well, you know what? I just said that's all he knows. That may not be fair, but you said a minute ago, it's what he has seen work. Why do people become drug dealers? Why are there so many of them out there? Maybe it's because they see it work for somebody else. They might die at 25 or 30 years old, but in those 25 or 30 years, they get to have some money, maybe even a lot of money, and get to be a king of their own little area, their own little neighborhood. They got something, rather than starving to death or being a drug taker themselves, drug user themselves.
Although, I don't get the impression that Chiron is really enjoying his wealth. I mean, he has a nice car, but again, that's part of the performance. Whether he would pick that car or not, really left to his own devices if he was brought up differently.
Doesn't drink, probably doesn't get high on his own supply either.
His expenses seem to just be performative about whatever props he needs to help be black. as he calls him.
This movie lets us fill in a lot of blanks. We don't see much of his life, and that's the version of him we see the most. Juan is dead after about the 30-minute mark. We don't even see that happen. They just talk about it. And that's even barely mentioned by Teresa and the teenage version of Chiron. And then the longest sequence of the three is definitely Trevante Rhodes' part of it, where it's not quite an hour, but almost an hour of this not quite two-hour movie.
It doesn't feel like the longest. It's certainly when the film really starts to crackle and come alive. I enjoyed the whole movie more the second time. But I remember seeing it in the theater, enjoying the first two acts intellectually, and then not really feeling very emotionally invested until the third act. I'm sorry to say, I was emotionally invested in the first two acts.
But you were fully in by that point.
But the third act breaks my heart. To the point where even the second time watching it, I was thinking about it for a week following. It's so moving and it gets so deeply in your head. There's few characters on film that I can say I feel a stronger connection with than Chiron. And that's saying a lot considering I could hardly be farther from his lived experience. Yeah. And I understand that. That's part of the appeal of the film. It's like any great work of art. It allows you to live a foreign experience and allows you to really, truly feel empathy for something that's alien to you.
That's what you should want when you watch movies. Not maybe every time, but when you see an art movie like this, you should want to see something that you're not used to and feel differently about things, maybe even change your worldview about things.
And I'm glad you said art movie, because that was one of the things about Moonlight that stands out. I mean, most films that are made about the projects, about the poor, you know, gritty reality movies, they tend to use a style that's more documentary. They want to make you feel like you're there and make it feel real. But Moonlight...
it's very pretty.
It's very pretty, and it's arty. It's just plain arty. It employs surreal techniques. The images don't necessarily always match with the audio. It's very colorful. The music is very moody. There are long sequences that are more atmospheric than anything else. And that's like a radical way to see this world.
Yeah, Barry Jenkins did a great job in all those facets. Certainly directing these actors as well. Most people we didn't really know very well, including Ali and Harris. Harris we knew the most of all these actors, but a lot of them are newcomers. You know what? We buried the lead in a lot of things here. Some quick numbers, so I'll do that right now. Rotten Tomatoes, 98% of critics liked that movie. That's pretty good. Very good, actually. 277 fresh, 7 rotten, but only 80% of audiences. Almost a 20% swing.
It is an art film. I have friends who just could not find a way to come to this movie. Yeah. And we know someone who turned it off halfway through because they
the
were
old
just,
handy.
They were too skeeved out by the, what I consider, a pretty chaste and delicate sex scene.
You know what's happening, but you see nothing.
Yeah, you hear it. And it feels authentic. In the
still
way,
pretty classily done for a hand job scene.
Yeah, it's certainly not remotely pornographic. No.
It only gets a 7.5 on the IMDb. Although La La Land is in the top 250, it's 8.2 or something. So La La Land is more popular with general audiences.
It's more popular with IMDb voters, which, as we've discussed before, is a particular group of people.
Yeah, that's
it doesn't true. Necessarily reflect general audiences.
I was looking
but...
through that list again yesterday, and there's some movies on there I've never even heard of. And I've watched and heard of a lot of movies. So that's
yeah,
something.
And it's, yeah, the most highly rated films of all time. But even that being said, I'm pretty confident that in a general population, La La Land probably is a more popular film. I get how... Moonlight is simply more challenging.
A musical that's more accessible in 2016, imagine that.
And a cute light romance with two of the most lovable
well, that's why
creatures
it's more accessible.
In Hollywood. Yeah, yeah, of course.
And a basic love story is really what it comes down to as well. Many top critics ranked Moonlight as number one in 2016. A lot of them really did. And Roger Ebert, if he was still alive, I think he would have too.
Oh, hell yeah. He loved stuff like this.
He had a black wife and obviously a black family through her. And a lot of times his number one movie of the year was either interracial or was flattered about black culture. Like Eve's Bayou is a movie that he raved about in 1997. A movie I'd never even heard of at the time and only saw it maybe 10 or 15 years later.
And he always had lots of praise for any movie that could bear that uncomfortable mantle of being an important film without letting it weigh it down.
Yeah.
Which is something you could definitely say about Moonlight.
Moonlight was 92nd at the 2016 U.S. box office, so obviously not exactly a huge hit. But like I said, it did fine for a movie that only cost a couple million bucks. The Disney properties, Rogue One, Finding Dory, and Captain America 3, were 1, 2, and 3. I think we talked about that in our Oscars podcast when we also talked about Moonlight as well. And little did we know it was going to win. We didn't do a post-Oscar show. We only did a pre-Oscar show. And you said you thought it should win. I didn't really agree that it should win, but neither of us thought it was going to, I don't think. And then, of course, the infamous thing at the show itself.
I was thrilled once I got over the shock and scandal of the wrong name being called.
Moonlight didn't even shoot for a month and was made for less than $2 million. This is an interesting thing about this movie, maybe more than anything else. It is a rare, if not the only time, we've ever had a Best Picture winner that was an LGBT theme and also an all-black cast. If there's any white people, they're inconsequential in the background.
Yeah, they don't have speaking parts. There's not a single white person with a speaking part. You don't realize it the first time you watch the movie, though.
Because you're in the world. It's just like when you watch a movie that's mostly white people, and until the last several years of reading this kind of stuff online and not wanting to be somebody who's excluding anyone else, I never really noticed so many movies didn't have black people or didn't have women before or didn't have speaking parts for black people or Indians or whatever. Indians as in the country, not people from over here. Or women. I didn't really notice those kinds of things that they didn't have until it was pointed out to me in so many movies that we've all loved over the years.
Mm-hmm. And representation is important. We've talked about it 100 times. This is a wonderful introduction to a world that rarely makes suburban theaters. And it certainly mm-hmm. never wins Best Picture awards.
And I remember saying this in the Oscar preview show. I didn't even know anything about this movie going into it. I sat down and didn't know anything. I don't even know if I knew that Harrison Ali were in it. Not that they're big names, but they're the biggest names in this whole film.
Oh, I knew so much. I'd heard... Well, Barry Jenkins was just a darling all year. And I think I listened to a few interviews that he did. And I read a few things about it. So I knew a fair amount going in. I knew a fair amount about the play. Right? I don't think it was a produced play. It was unproduced, yeah. And it was based on a play called In Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue mm-hmm. by...
Terrell Alvin McCraney. This is his first ever movie as a writer. Yeah.
I don't know how Barry Jenkins ever got his hands on this play, but it was very autobiographical, and Barry Jenkins also shared a lot of the experiences. Yeah. They both grew up in that same project.
Liberty City, in Miami.
They both grew up there. I think they both had mothers with drug addictions. They both had a Juan-type character.
And when word got out about some of those things, that's one reason why the locals didn't give them trouble. Because you think it'd be tough to shoot on location in any kind of place. Well, anywhere could be tough. I mean, even the poshest place in Manhattan can be tough to shoot. But certainly a place that is known for being tough like that. But when they found out about Jenkins and McCraney's backgrounds, then it was, okay, you're in.
People like us have these expectations or these stories that we believe to be true about projects in the inner city in America. And these people really get to tell their own stories. But when they do, they get an opportunity to say, it's not like what you think. And so the people of Liberty City, knowing that they could trust their stories in the hands of these alumni of Liberty City, were thrilled that somebody was going to tell their story. But I'm sure nobody expected this film to be seen by all that many people when it got made. It's the definition of indie. It's like you said, shot in 20 days. Naomi Harris was only on set for 3 days.
And she's the only actor that's in all three sequences.
She's in tons of the film. She has like 15, 20 minutes of screen time. 3 days on set to get that much screen time. She must have got her takes right
constantly then.
Oh my gosh, she is a professional. And for that work, without rehearsal either.
And she's not a drug addict anyway. She's apparently a completely clean person. So she was truly acting this drug addict character.
She's not even American either.
Right.
She's British. She's known for playing Moneypenny.
Right. And Pirates of the Caribbean, she was in that.
Oh, was she? Those, okay. At least, yeah. I always remember her from 28 Days
that's
Later.
That's what I was thinking of her too. Yeah. She's been in a ton of movies, actually. She's been in more movies than probably anybody else of the major cast members. But she's still not, I would say, a star. But she's great in this small role. And it's funny, too, because in the very beginning, she's relatively normal. She's mean to Juan. She's not very nice to him. But otherwise, she looks like she's okay. But, of course, that makes sense. You don't just break down immediately when you start doing drugs. It takes a while.
Mm-hmm.
And we see her over the years where she looks worse and worse. Although she at least is getting clean. Or maybe, I guess you could say, has gotten clean when the adult Chiron visits her in, a prison or a drug rehab facility.
I think it's a rehab facility that she's just decided to not leave. She says at one point, as long as I work, they'll let me stay.
Oh.
So that's just where she wants to be. McCraney wrote the play, he says, to help himself cope with his own mother's death from AIDS.
Oh.
I can't begin to imagine how fraught that relationship would be and what that would do to a person. Although the movie helps us imagine what it's like to just have no reliable parent in your life than to cope with their redemption or their death or their metamorphosis over the course of your life.
And Chiron beats the odds by not becoming a brute. If he is, we don't see anything like that. Yeah, he's a drug dealer, but like I say, he seems to be a reasonable, decent one, as they go, at least. He could be somebody, and maybe deserves to be somebody, who's taking guns to people. Maybe that happens. We don't see it in the movie. The only real big violence in the whole film is when he breaks that chair over that guy's head, that bully, that closeted gay kid, who obviously...
Oh my god, the bully Terrell is...
He's either gay, or he is a burgeoning serial killer.
Every single performance in this film is award-worthy. Barry Jenkins has many gifts, but he obviously has a touch with actors, and he has all these fresh faces, these unknown actors, and the performances are so exceptional. One thing that I don't think people really talked about much is the performance of Terrell, the bully, who includes just enough subtle touches to give you pause, to make you think a little more about what's motivating this kid to be so mean to Chiron and everybody else. And like you said, he's clearly a closeted homosexual. It seems really obvious. And I'll note that his name is Terrell, and the playwright's name is Terrell. They spell it differently, but come on.
Well, there are a lot of tough themes in the whole film. His gayness, the bullying, racism is not really a factor in this, I guess, but you know that they would have dealt with that at some point in their lives, because every black kid in America undoubtedly does.
And just the place that they're in, where they're surrounded by people of color, and they're all so poor that their soccer ball is like a papier-mâché. They're clearly poor, they're clearly struggling, and they're clearly all people of color.
And of course, drug addiction is another big theme. And there's always simmering threats of violence. But there's no guns that we see. You know there are guns at some point. You can't be a drug dealer and not have guns somewhere. But I like that touch. It's a very interesting one. People criticize Spike Lee for not having any drugs and Do the Right Thing. But he chose not to focus on that in this day in the life of and Do the Right Thing. It's only one day on that block in Brooklyn.
There is an alcoholic in that movie, too. I find that criticism so problematic.
Yeah, sometimes you can't cram everything into one little movie, especially in that case where it's a one-day story.
Why do you have to assume that a movie about black people in the city has to include a drug addict? Because I don't think that would be
and
true
I'm only
about a
saying,
movie about white people in
and
the
I'm
city.
Only saying the guns have to be a part of Chiron and or Juan's lives because they're drug dealers.
Well, the movie clearly makes tons of choices. It makes more choices about what not to include than about what to include. You and I both know that guns exist in this world, but because they don't matter in these important moments in Chiron's life, they don't happen in the movie. Much like we know Juan dies and we know that that's an important moment, but that's not the moment we're focusing on. So that happens in the background when we're not looking. Paula getting clean happens in the background when we're not looking. Moving to Atlanta happens in the background. You know, him starting his whole new life. These are just things that we kind of have to learn about. I love this directorial touch that every time we switch to a new scene, he makes us work hard to catch up with what's happened to the characters since we were last there, particularly in the third act, because a lot changes between the second and third act. When the director makes you pay attention, it just serves to further invest you in the film and in the story, and just kind of makes you look closer and listen closer.
The link, I think, is that at least twice, and maybe in all three instances with the three versions of the kid, he wakes up from a nightmare.
Oh, yeah. And he has erotic dreams in two of the three acts as well.
Right. The ending moments of the three sequences would be the faggot conversation. And by the way, I've always hated that word. It's not a word I've really ever used before except to quote the movie, but I am quoting the movie. I won't use the other word. Although, is that really ever said, though? Is the N-word really said in this movie? Because it is a... Oh, yeah, they say it about each other.
Yeah, they say it to each other in the friendly
But not
way.
Constantly, at least. And really not that much. So anyway, that conversation ends the kid version, attacking the bully with the chair when he goes WWE on the guy, ends the second version, and then the hug ends the whole movie. So it's the conversation where the kid is told by an authority figure that he respects, it's okay to be gay. And then it's beating on somebody for taunting him for being gay, and among other things, I suppose. And that's finally accepting the fact, hey, I am gay, and I haven't been with anybody other than you in all that time. How does anybody go a decade without some kind of sexual contact?
Not even just sexual, but comfort.
Yeah, okay.
Because it's not a sexual moment. It's not an erotic moment.
Yeah.
It's just an intimate moment. And that's what he hasn't had the whole film. There are hours of buildup of loneliness. We see everything from Chiron's perspective. There's only two scenes in the whole movie that don't include him, which is the opening scene where we meet the crack dealer and his customer who looks like the mirror image of him 20 years in the future. And the same location later when Juan discovers and confronts Paula smoking crack.
Right.
But other than that, the camera's always where Chiron is. If he's on the ground, we see the world from that perspective. If he's driving, the camera showing us everything passing by. If he's swimming, the camera is dipping in and out of the water so much that you're tempted to hold your breath. Jenkins makes us live with him. Every moment of the film, you are reminded and forced to confront how lonely his life is. That moment of catharsis at the end is overwhelming. I find it so powerful.
It's a strange touch, too, that the sex scene they have, the hand job, comes early on, or not even really midway through, because like we say, Trevante Rhodes is in more of the movie than the other two, probably combined, actually, the other two versions of the same character. But the hand job or an actual sex scene, even kissing, is not redone in the climax. It's just that comforting hug. Chiron is camera right in the hand job scene, and at the very end of the film, in the hug, he's on the left. I don't know if that means anything, but it's probably a deliberate touch. What side of the frame is the character on?
Obviously, it's done on purpose. Jenkins is obviously an incredibly thoughtful filmmaker, and there's tons of intention behind what he does. There's a lot of attention to detail. And I think it's important that moment isn't erotic, because what's pent up in him that's frustrating, and we see twice in the film that he ejaculates in his sleep. This man who is repressed. But the real breakthrough is the intimacy.
I'm sure at some point that night or in the very near future they're going to have bonafide sex.
But we don't need to see it. And that's not what we would be grateful to see. That's not what we need him to have.
Well, the Kevin and Chiron reunion could have gone in so many different directions. Because for one thing, the teenage version of Kevin beat the shit out of the teenage version of Chiron, who wouldn't stay down. And that was, I think, the very next scene after they'd had their moment on the beach.
He didn't break the chair over Kevin's back. He knew it wasn't Kevin's fault.
No, I'm not saying that. But anybody could feel hate towards somebody who did that to him, no matter the reason. Could you really blame him for hating Kevin? Or even just maybe wanting to get some kind of revenge?
I didn't get the impression that he was mad at Kevin at any point for that. He was just mad at Terrell. Maybe he was humiliated. I think he was humiliated in front of Kevin. So there's that way that he probably has internalized so much self-loathing. He's obviously in love with Kevin, and there probably isn't a worse person in the world that he could have been beat down by than by Kevin. And maybe Terrell knows that. Those two are together.
So. Well, they knew each other for a long time. They knew each other's lives for a couple decades in total, I guess, because they know each other's little kids and then teenagers and then as grown men. Well, when they do meet, and Kevin is a cook, and he makes that meal for Chiron, he doesn't need to get Chiron drunk. He's kind of a sure thing. It's like that line in Pretty Woman. Let me give you a tip. I'm a sure thing.
There's so many amazing moments in that scene, and the way they delicately dance with each other, the way they have this conversation where they ask these questions that have inferred meaning, like, why did you call me? Let me play this song for you. And the song is a romantic song about reuniting lovers, and the little touches, like one will pay the other a compliment and the smile on his face. But most of all, my favorite moment is in the car when he's driving Kevin home. He's like, why'd you drive all the way down here? Oh, you know, I meant to look up how long the drive is between Atlanta and Miami. I'm sure it's a day, right? No, maybe not a day, but hours, many hours. But he says, why'd you drive all the way down here? And then he says, where are you going to stay tonight? Chiron just turns the music up and smiles. And the smile on Kevin's face in that moment, all this wondering, this back and forth, they're so careful. It's actually kind of mirrored, or I should say it's a mirror of the scene when they're on the beach and they go to kiss each other. And you know they both want to, but they're so afraid of being wrong. But in that scene, the stakes are high because if Chiron is misinterpreting Kevin's intentions and he goes to kiss him, Kevin could tell everybody that he's gay. This would surely end in violence and make him completely alone in the world. But then the consequences of him being rejected in the diner scene or in the car, he's waited what seems like close to a decade to reach out and make himself vulnerable for the first time in all these years. The pain of that rejection, if he's wrong about that, I don't know if anybody, or certainly not this person, could recuperate from that kind of rejection.
Yeah, probably not.
The fear that they both have, and Kevin's clearly just more confident and together and just not as damaged of a person as Chiron is, but he still loves Chiron. They still have this connection. There still is something special between them. Oh God, it's so beautiful. Like, even just talking about it now makes my heart want to burst.
Well, when they first meet in that diner, the phrase, level you with their eyes, came to mind.
And then he cooks for him. There's this really strong association in the film that food is love and Chiron is starving. So when first time he meets Juan, he immediately takes him to a restaurant, feeds him, and all he does is eat. And then he goes home and he meets Teresa. And what does she do? She puts food in front of him and he eats and eats and eats. In the scene where he learns that Juan is, or confirms that Juan is a drug dealer, they've put a glass of juice in front of him and he doesn't touch it. He doesn't want their love. In that moment, he's too disgusted.
It obviously goes back, though.
Oh, yeah, because him and Teresa are still close. Mm. We never see her in the third act, but she's referred to by Paula.
Yeah.
So we know that she's still in his life.
Janelle Monáe was in two movies last year, and I think she's very new to movies. I don't think she's done too much more than that, because she is in Hidden Figures, and so is Mahershala Ali, actually. And you love that movie. I like that movie, too. She's a stunner. And she has poise, just like Gene Tierney did when we watched Laura, which was just last week.
You've never been a fan of her musically. You never really knew that she was a musician.
I don't know her at all.
If you think she's beautiful in these movies, and she is. Yeah. She's just such a knockout. It blows your mind. And she's also, like you said, so watchable. Like, there's something so classy, lovely about. Oh my God, she's amazing. I've been a fan of her since her first album, and then also because I, at the time, worked for a music television station. I cut many interviews with her, and oh, God, she's amazing. I've been a fan of hers for a long time, and I am thrilled that she is also an amazing actress.
But why is someone as together as Teresa dating a drug dealer?
We don't know much about her. How together do you think she is?
She seems pretty normal to me. Not
that
one's not normal.
Their house is so normal. It's so clean and tidy and crisp sheets. It seems like a suburban home. It's kind of strange that Juan lives that way because he has this double life. You're Chiron, and you're watching this. You know that everything he does as a drug dealer is performative. So Chiron knows, oh, okay, living double lives, that's what you do. You have the person that you are at home, and then you have the person that you are when you're at work.
Let me quote a line I wrote on Facebook the night of the Oscars when Mahershala Ali won Best Supporting Actor. A Swede in a movie about a transsexual presents an Oscar to a black Muslim in a movie about a gay guy. That's America, Mr. Traitor-in-Chief. Now, to explain, the Swede is Alicia Vikander, who'd been in The Danish Girl, where she won the Supporting Actress Oscar. And one of my favorite Facebook posts ever.
And he was one of the, or he is the first Muslim to ever win an Oscar in the acting category.
I think you already said the three actors that play Chiron, but to say them again, Alex Hibbert, who is the kid version. This is his only movie credit so far. I'm sure he'll be in more things. Ashton Sanders is the teen Chiron, still new, but was in Straight Outta Compton. And then Trevante Rhodes, that's a sensitive man. He is going to be good.
Yeah, he has very little experience.
Yeah, he'll be in the new Predator movie.
I can't wait to see what he does. I hope he's successful. I hope he gets the franchise. I hope he's a huge movie star. But I really would love to see him in more movies like this that show that subtlety. Yeah. There's so much depth in his performance, and he is just so good at expressing two things at once. You know, machismo and vulnerability. He can hold those two things in his hands, and he can perform both of those things. And it's so authentic and believable. His performance blows me away.
Unlike most modern actors, he's so jacked that he's going to be very believable in a movie like The Predator, just like he's believable in a movie like this.
He looks like an action star, but I want to see
him do more. He's got Brando qualities.
Yes,
that's a strong thing to say, but similar-ish at least.
Listen, man, I feel like I could watch that guy do anything at this point. He's also so cute.
He's a good-looking man.
He is an attractive man.
And Andre Holland plays the older Kevin. He's one of the more experienced actors of all these people. He was in 42 in Selma, so he's done a lot of movies about race and race relations. Barry Jenkins, his only other release so far is Medicine for Melancholy. I never heard of that before. So he basically is, well, not rookie, I guess, a sophomore, and he directs the Best Picture winner. Didn't win the award himself. He is the fourth black Best Director nominee ever. John Singleton for Boys in the Hood, we covered that last year. Lee Daniels for Precious a couple of years ago, and Steve McQueen for The Great 12 Years a Slave. So most of those are pretty recent.
And none of them have won yet. Mm-hmm. A lot of people were outraged about the accidental La La Land call, that it stole Moonlight's thunder.
And it did.
Although I say, when you think about it, people are going to remember this Best Picture win forever, and everybody's going to remember Moonlight because of this. Because let me tell you, people do not remember. You ask them, who won the Oscar for Best Picture last year?
Spotlight.
You know that. But I'm telling you, Spotlight, like, most people don't remember. All that being said, everyone was outraged about that, and they were saying that it was annoying that there was all these white people on stage taking away from this black movie's success.
But what were they supposed to do?
I disagree with that criticism. I think the criticism should be directed to the fact that Damien Chazelle won Best Director while Barry Jenkins didn't, because Moonlight is a better directed film than La La Land. La La Land gets a lot of points for difficulty, I suppose, but the fact is Moonlight is a better movie. And it's kind of outrageous that the last two, I'll say, black movies to win Best Picture, 12 Years a Slave and Moonlight, neither of them won for Best Director, even though they were, like, very arty, visually driven films that had visionary directors. You can't say it was just the script, it was just the performances. These men deserve credit for their work, and they're not getting it. It probably has to do with the voting body. Oh, that's true.
They're getting credit. They're just not winning the ultimate award.
And Barry Jenkins won the screenwriting award with McCraney.
And McQueen won Best Picture. He's one of the producers on 12 Years a Slave.
Okay. But I think there should be some outrage there, that there's some resistance. And it probably comes down to the voting body, because directors vote for Best Director.
I have heard
most film directors are white men. Why do you think that Best Picture and Best Director so often wind up being different films?
They've been split a lot recently. They hadn't been for a while there between the mid-2000s until Argo. And that happened with Argo. Ben Affleck wasn't even nominated, but his movie won. But again, at least he was a producer, so he took home an Oscar that night for producing. 12 Years a Slave was the next year after that. And then it was Birdman, which is not a split, but Spotlight was split, Picture and Director. And then again last year, Moonlight and La La Land. Why does it keep happening? you could say they're spreading the wealth around, I guess. You could argue it's one of those past due, this guy finally should win, but I don't know if that's really true about Alfonso Cuarón for Gravity, the year 12 Years Later.
Certainly not Chazelle.
And I love Whiplash. People have heard me say that before. I think that's a way better movie than La La Land. I think La La Land is very good, too. But yeah, he's, I think, the youngest ever winner of Best Director. It's not like he's a guy who's made 15 or 20 movies. Not the Scorsese year or something like that. So why does it keep getting split? I don't know. When Morgan Freeman read Spotlight 2 years ago, that shocked everybody. It only won the screenplay Oscar, and it's a very good movie. But I wouldn't have given it Best Picture.
There was just no obvious choice that year. I think it's really...
And that's maybe true about this past year, too.
No, this past year, the playing field had been narrowed down to Moonlight or La La Land. They were the two darlings of the year, and people loved them. La La Land, a lot of people have agreed, was overhyped. That's probably its biggest flaw. If I saw that movie in the festival not knowing anything about it, I would have probably loved it, too. I would have been just so dazzled and delighted. It was just so fun and effervescent.
And a great callback to old musicals. It looked fantastic.
The music was great. The cast, they're just so
good. It was charming. Fun. The one real problem with Moonlight, I think, and maybe there isn't room for it, but there's no levity. I don't think there's one laugh in the whole movie.
Laugh that the audience is in on, at least.
If there's any laughs, period, it's one or two, and I can't even think of any of them, so I don't think there really are.
Yeah.
And by the way, let's get off the Best Picture controversy here, but one more thing I got to say. Full marks to Jordan Horowitz, because I don't think anybody could handle that any better than he did, which is to say, listen, guys, this is not right. I'm not kidding. And he rips the card out of Warren Beatty's hands and shows, as people point out, how did that cameraman get that perfectly framed and in-focus shot of it saying Best Picture Moonlight?
They're pros.
And if people don't remember the controversy, I mean, we didn't really explain this movie very well, but the controversy was that Warren Beatty was handed the Best Actress card. I don't know why that idiot backstage, the guy who looks like Matt Damon's dad, didn't just tear it up. What does he have, 24 envelopes? They apparently have one set on either side. So wherever the presenters come from, the woman that's with that guy or that guy give the envelope to one of the presenters. So when a category is over with, put it in a bag or your pocket or get a shredder or something, you moron. Or even just check it. Look at it, you fucking idiot.
Yeah, it was really stupid.
And he deserved to get fired.
How many years? What is it, 89 Academy Awards? Mm-hmm. In all those years, it's the first time they've ever called out a wrong name.
They always said that they would come out on stage and interrupt somebody if somebody was goofing around or was just reading it wrong. The whole controversy about Marissa Tomei winning way back when, people said that Jack Palance read the wrong name. But the PricewaterhouseCoopers people who've been doing this for a long time said if that had happened, we would have walked out on stage and said, nope, that's wrong. But they didn't do it then because it wasn't wrong. And look what they did this time. It took a little while to get it going, actually, because when we were watching the show, we thought, what is that commotion back there? A lot of people go on stage. All the actors go up there. The cinematographer went up there and the composer. All the producers, of course. Chazelle was up there. But there were still more people than there should have been. The headsets. You see the headsets in the background. I think, what are they doing? And that was when we realized something is up here. Mm-hmm. And we watched it over and over again when it was over. You are up late beyond your hours as it was. And you're up even longer than you intended to be.
Or to quote my friend Michelle, her best tweet of the night was, I'm watching this thing like it's a Zapruder film. Because we just kept rewinding and watching over and over and remarking on every single detail. And I think when you watch it over and over again, you forget how caught up people can be in the moment. There was some criticism, but when you consider that nobody could have possibly expected that to happen, could have possibly have mentally prepared a reaction for that moment, under those circumstances, I think they reacted very well. They reacted pretty quickly.
I don't know. I'm thinking about it as you say that right now, that the Oscar goes to La La Land. Okay, then everybody gets up. The music is playing. Everybody walks on stage. That's got to be 20 or 30 seconds. Why aren't... Well, then the guy was fucking tweeting, I guess. But why aren't those two people saying to the stage manager and, of course, the producer and everybody else, no, that's wrong, very quickly. I don't know
what's
going on.
You just panic and don't know what to do. It took them a couple of minutes, and I get that it was maybe too long, but, you know, give them a little slack for dealing with this situation for the first time in history.
At least they did get it right. And then, of course, everybody involved from La La Land was very classy, especially Jordan Horowitz. I'll be very proud to hand this to my friends from Moonlight. It was a very nice line.
Yeah, which was a comeback to Jimmy Kimmel being like, why can't everybody get an Oscar? And he's like, no. This is Moonlight. I want to give it to them. They earned it.
And I just read yesterday that Jimmy Kimmel's coming back next year. So he even said at the end, I knew I'd screw this up somehow. Well, I guess they liked him and they bring him back. He did a good job, actually, for the most part.
He was okay.
Some of the comedy bits were
my favorite, but it's just like an impossible gig to have.
It's almost pointless after the monologue.
Oh, yeah.
You don't really need it at all once they've done that.
Anyways, let's move on.
Yeah, so let's get back to one more thing I want to say about Jenkins' direction. He has a lot of shots that follow the characters around, whether they're walking or in cars or what have you. That reminded me a lot of the way that Jake Gittes is going around town in Chinatown. The camera's often following him because he is our main character, and he's the guy that we're finding everything through. We don't learn anything that Gittes doesn't learn. Which I guess is true about Chiron in this movie. We don't know anything that he doesn't know, apart from those two scenes you talked about.
We see the world from his perspective, but he doesn't really let us in Chiron's head very easily. That's something that we really have to work for, and he does that by putting the camera behind him. He does that also by the writing making Chiron so tight-lipped. He never gives us the cliff notes of what he's thinking or feeling. He's painfully quiet. We're forced to pay attention and infer what he's experiencing. And there's a power in that silence as a technique to just force us to sit and contemplate what he's thinking and feeling rather than give us the easy version.
So Jenkins and McCraney won the Oscar for the adapted screenplay. All three Black screenwriting Oscar wins are recent. Precious was a few years ago, and 12 Years a Slave was not that long after that. And it was rare before they even got nominated. But at least they're finally starting to win more often these days. People who don't look like you and me. Good for them. The producers were Dee Dee Gardner, Jeremy Kleiner, and Adele Romansky. Even though Jenkins, I believe, spoke when they all went up there after the snafu, he was not one of the producers. Credit to Dee Dee Gardner, who's now won 2 Oscars in recent years, because the other one was 12 Years a Slave. She is Brad Pitt's producing partner, and Kleiner is also in that company. And Pitt apparently is one of the people that was behind the scenes getting involved. His Plan B production company did help make this movie, but Pitt wasn't a credited producer like he was on 12 Years a Slave. But Gardner is one of the powerhouse producers of the modern era, period, but certainly one of the more powerful women producers, as is Kathleen Kennedy, who's done so many great movies. We talked about that, I think it was this past year's Oscar preview show, or maybe it was last year's. Anyway, those are 2 huge names in the producing camp, and they're both very powerful, talented women.
That's the one job that women in Hollywood seem to be breaking out in more than virtually any other. I don't know what it is that's special about producing, but you really do see a lot more women up there.
With so many Best Picture nominees in the recent years since they expanded it all those years ago, I don't know if it's half, but it feels like it's at least 40% of the time. If there's 50 total producers, because of course most movies have 2 or 3, sometimes even 4, and we've had as many as 9 Best Picture, maybe even 10 actually, Best Picture nominees. So whatever it is, for the numbers there, I think probably about half have been women, lots of times. And Gardner's been in there plenty of times. She's won 2, but she's been nominated more than that. The movie is 2-3-5-2-1. We watched the Blu-ray, made sure to get that version of it. It's also on Netflix, though, if you want to see it and don't own it, and it's no doubt on demand, I'm sure. Cinematographer was James Laxton, who shot Tusk for Kevin Smith, and I didn't see any other credits on his resume that really stand out. Maybe he will get a lot more movies now because he was nominated for this one. They used different film stocks for the different chapters, and they reminded me of Traffic with its different filters way back when Steven Soderbergh did that to differentiate all the sequences in the different places.
They didn't shoot it on film. They shot it digital, but they worked with a color corrector to mimic very specific film stocks.
Oh, I misread that then.
Yeah, which is probably, I imagine, what a lot of cinematographers do. I mean, it's rarer and rarer that anyone shoots on film, but I can't imagine you could shoot an indie in 20 days.
On film.
On film. Sure, yeah. I mean, I suppose you could, but no, they shot it up
digital. I shouldn't be calling anything film stock anymore unless it's Chris Nolan, maybe Spielberg and Tarantino, and that's about it for people that use film anymore. Even Scorsese, I believe, has gone digital. The editors were Nat Sanders, who was a cutter on Girls, the TV show that just ended a few months ago, and Joie McMillan, who's the first ever Black woman nominee in the editing category.
Also the first gay woman.
Oh, she's gay.
Yeah.
And the composer, Nicholas Britell, did music on The Big Short. Dee Dee Gardner and Brad Pitt produced that one as well. And he was a producer on Whiplash, of all things. I guess because of the music, right? He had to help out with all the jazz. There is actually a decent amount of influence for a movie that's this recent. It's influenced by The Age of Innocence in this one way. The one touch can sustain a man for a long time. That's a very important point in The Age of Innocence, the Scorsese movie. Maybe an indie movie with this much exposure can help closeted kids like Chiron. Milk, the movie that Sean Penn was in all those years ago, seemed to have helped some people. Hopefully, anyway, people can realize that it's okay to live like this.
Yeah, and surely Brokeback and Carol and all kinds of other LGBTQ movies.
Getting that fairly big releases. Oscar-type buzz and all that kind of thing.
I mean, we feel this movie this hard, and we can't relate to his experience in our own lives at all. Can you even begin to imagine what a revelation this movie would be to any kid growing up in Liberty City or any projects in America? Any kid suffering from poverty or drug-addicted mother, or any kid who's a homosexual or any other kind of pariah identity struggling already.
Could save their life.
Absolutely. I mean,
a movie could save somebody's life, and that's actually possible, isn't it, in this case?
We've all had pieces of art that have reflected our experience back, and we all know what that feeling is to see ourselves in art, and so that's part of the reason why it's so meaningful to have representation in Hollywood and film.
Another influence, I think it got the votes for Best Picture partly as a rebuke to Donald Trump.
Oh yeah, you always said that because it's like the anti-Trump. It's a film about all the people who never would vote for Trump in a million years and who are probably going to suffer, probably
they are
already suffering under Trump's policies. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, Hollywood certainly likes to talk the talk.
They want to be on the cutting edge of what's going on in the world.
Well, they want to appear to be on the cutting edge.
At least appear, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, the awards and list section is pretty strong, but only in the Oscar category. It won 3 Best Picture, Supporting Actor for Ali and the Adapted Screenplay. It was nominated for 5 others, Best Director, Supporting Actress Naomi Harris, the Editing, the Cinematography, and the Music Score. Director, Cinematography, and Music all went to La La Land, which did win a lot more. I think it won 6 to Moonlight's 3. It didn't win the PGA, so the Producers Guild Award, the SAG, that's the Screen Actors, or the Directors Guild Award. And this is the first movie since Braveheart to win Best Picture at the Oscars, but not those other ones.
Really?
Mm-hmm. That's what I was reading.
All those other award bodies are wrong.
All right, then, last thoughts on Moonlight.
I just find it so deeply moving. It was my favorite film of 2016. I was thrilled when it won Best Picture. It's a beautiful, heartbreaking work of art, and I predict it will be a classic. It's going to age really well.
And I think the one weakness is it doesn't have any humor. And maybe there's no room for it, but it would have been nice to have a little bit more of that. But it's a deeply felt romantic movie, good acting across the board, and it shows things we rarely see in movies. Next week, we put out our final June podcast, and we're going to dig into something a lot more cynical than Moonlight. Burt Lancaster and Tony Curtis are right bastards in Sweet Smell of Success, one of my favorite movies ever. The coming attraction trivia for Sweet Smell of Success. One of my favorite movie quotes is in Sweet Smell, and it's, "Match me, Sydney." We'll certainly talk about that next week. Longtime listeners of this podcast may remember what I've said is the single greatest movie quote of all time. And it is not on the AFI's Top 100 Quotes list, by the way. What is that quote?
Oh no, I'm going to get a divorce next week. Shoot.
Well, it's not really asking you necessarily, it's asking the listeners and you.
Help me, listeners. Have you been listening closer than me? Please say you have. All right, so for the answer to that, please tune in to next week's podcast about Sweet Smell of Success. And in the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, and while you're there, check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered 200 movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free. And while you're there, rate us, review us. It helps people find us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis. And Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
You should make me dinner and then hold me.
Okay.
Easy sell there,
isn't it? It's a deal. And cut.